This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Millions of Americans struggle to pay for health care. Journalist Jonathan Cohn traveled across the country to report on the impact that struggle is having on individuals and families. A senior editor at the New Republic, Cohn is the author of the book Sick, The Untold Story of America's Health Care Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. He is our guest in this portion of the program. Cohn has looked at health care by looking at the experiences Americans have had with the system. He begins Sick with a look at the state of emergency rooms. The situation he finds is 911. He finds overcrowded ERs and ERs that, due to overcrowding, close their doors to incoming patients, diverting ambulance traffic. One person he writes about, 55-year-old Cynthia Klein, dies because the cardiac procedure that could save her life is not available in the ER that has room for her. Cohn says most experts see overcrowded emergency rooms as a symptom of other systemic problems now plaguing medical care. He says it's time for a new political discussion on health care. This afternoon, we'll talk with him about what he learned about the state of health care in the U.S., how we got here, and what might be done to improve the situation. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Jonathan Cohn, our guest, writes mainly about domestic politics and policy, focusing on health care and social welfare. In addition to being a senior editor at the New Republic, he is also a contributing editor at the American Prospect. From 2002 through 2004, he was a media fellow with the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation. His book, Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price, is published by HarperCollins. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Jonathan Cohn, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Would you tell us Cynthia Klein's story?
Sure. Well, it happened just a few years ago in Boston, and ironic that it should be in Boston. You know, Boston is home to what is arguably the greatest single concentration of teaching hospitals in the country, if not the world. You have Harvard Medical School there, Boston University Medical School there, Tufts Medical School, and all these huge hospitals that, you know, regularly are in the news for these breaking treatments. Cynthia Klein had a heart attack. She had been dealing with coronary disease problems, and she knew enough. She was not a doctor or a nurse, but she knew enough to know that what she needed was a procedure to open up her clogged blood vessels. And she asked to go specifically to the hospital where she had been treated before. They could not go there because that hospital, like so many hospitals on any given day in any given city in the United States, was on diversion. It was overcrowded. In part because, well, we don't know exactly why it was overcrowded that day, that particular hospital, but in general we know that when hospitals are overcrowded like that, it is usually because they are inundated with people who don't have health insurance, and all hospitals around the country have also been re-engineered recently so that they tend not to have a lot of the space they used to have to send to refer patients. So they end up stacking up in the ERs, and they can't take new people, and they ended up taking her to another hospital, and it was a good hospital. It wasn't a bad hospital, but it did not have the advanced heart attack treatments that she needed, and before they could transfer her again to another hospital that had such technology, and I should mention that the other hospital that had it nearby was also on diversion that day, she passed away.
Hmm. In this introduction to the book, you talk about Massachusetts General closing its ER to incoming patients, at least when you were writing it, up to 45 hours a week. What does that, can you give us some sense of what that means and how common that is?
Well, it's common. Again, you could go to any city in the United States and you would see something like this, particularly in the larger cities. Hospitals have become inundated, and they cannot push people through the ER fast enough to keep up with the demand. And when that happens, people get turned away. You know, Massachusetts General Hospital, in Boston they call it man's greatest hospital. It may be actually man's greatest hospital. I mean, it's that well known. And yet they were closing 45 hours a week because they could not take more people. They were so backed up. And a lot of these people, and the reason I say this is symptomatic of larger problems with our healthcare system, is that a lot of these people are people who really could have been seen somewhere else earlier for a routine matter, but they didn't have health insurance. They had no way to get routine medical care, and so they waited and ended up with an emergency that had to be taken care of in an emergency room somewhere that would take care of them even if they didn't have insurance, and that basically is the emergency room.
Yeah. A symptom of other systemic problems plaguing medical care, folks without health insurance, you mentioned. Would you give us a broader overview of these underlying problems?
Well, I think the main underlying problem, and this is sort of the thread of the story that runs through the book, is that we are unique in the developed world in that we never have established health insurance as a basic right. Most other countries at some point said that, gee, having access to affordable medical care ought to be a minimum requirement for running a decent society. And every government found a way to give everybody health insurance. We've never done that. There are a number of reasons why. But as a result, we've come up with this crazy patchwork system, which starts with the job-based employer system. And basically the idea is the assumption is if you're working age, you will get health insurance from your employer. Now, lots of people who are working age don't get insurance from their employer. And as a result, after that, well, then it's sort of a game. And maybe you'll fall into a category of someplace where you can get insurance. Either you can buy it on your own or a government will help you get it. But there's a good chance you won't. And then you will end up to be like one of the 40-plus Americans who at any one time don't have health insurance. And this problem is growing. It has been really since the 1970s. And on top of that, we have a problem where even some people who have insurance find themselves in situations where they can't pay their medical bills. And you combine the two of those problems together, and you have a serious crisis on your hands. And it does affect people's health. It affects people's health when they can't get into the emergency room they want, or they end up getting substandard care. But, of course, more commonly, and I think this is something most people have probably heard at least one story they know of, it affects people financially. And it really ruins people's lives.
Yeah. How does the health care an insured person receives differ from that received by someone who's uninsured?
Well, typically, somebody who is insured will get preventative care. Someone who has insurance will get routine checkups. When you don't have health insurance, people assume that, oh, everyone who doesn't have health insurance, they still get medical care. Well, you know, if you show up at the door of the emergency room and you're bleeding to death, they will take you. There's a law that says they have to. It's a federal law. They will have to take care of you. They have to stabilize you. But if you just have an ache and a pain, you want to get checked out, well, not so much. They don't have to take you then, and there's a good chance they won't. And whenever you do get seen in an emergency room, of course, you will get billed for it. And they are quite aggressive about collecting these bills, and they're often very large bills. And, of course, these are typically people, you know, even very wealthy people can't, you know, usually stand to drop $10,000 or $20,000 on a dime, which is very easy to run up in an emergency room. So what ends up happening is that people who don't have health insurance, they frequently ration their own health care. They don't get the medical attention they need. And again, what ends up typically happening is they don't get routine care. They don't get preventative care. They don't check out the aches and pains. And then one day those aches and pains turn out to be something far more serious.
Yeah, as in the case of Betsy Rotzler. Tell us about her.
Yes, that's the first chapter in the book. And we catch up with the Rotzler family in the early 1990s, Gary and Betsy Rotzler, they were high school sweethearts. They've gotten married. They have on their way to having three young children. They've just bought a new house in a town in upstate New York, tucked into the foothills of the Catskill Mountains. It's a village, actually, officially. It's called Gilbertsville. It has a population of about 400 people. And they really feel like they're living out the American dream. Gary is working for a defense contractor. It's a job that pays him well. It's an engineering job. He's been trained for it. Everything seems to be going just fine until a wave of downsizing and outsourcing hits the region, partly as a result of the recession, partly because of defense cutbacks. And the result is that he loses his job. He's very industrious. He puts together a series of part-time temporary jobs to bring in some income. His wife, Betsy, she runs a daycare out of the house. They are able to replace some of their lost income. But as anybody who's had to be in this situation knows, if you can't get health insurance from your employer, it's very difficult to buy it on your own. It's it's more difficult to find it, and it tends to be more expensive. So they ended up going about 2 years without health insurance, and they did exactly what we just described. They didn't get routine care. They didn't get aches and pains checked out, and that turns out to be a tragic decision when Betsy Rotzler, who was experiencing some aches and pains, lets it go and lets it go and lets it go, and eventually by the time she does get it checked out, it turns out to be cancer that has spread, and she does, and she also ends up passing away, and her family ends up having to declare bankruptcy because even after she is gone, they are stuck with $50,000 in medical bills, which they cannot pay.
Yeah, and they got to borrow money for the funeral.
Yeah.
That's so sad. How many bankruptcies are the result of medical debt?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to pin a number on it because anybody, almost by definition, people who go into bankruptcy, there's usually more than one source of their debt. So it's hard to say it was this or that, and there's been some controversy over that. What I do think it is safe to say, what I say in the book, and what I don't know anybody seriously disagree with, is that it is a major cause of bankruptcy. And you can see this. You don't even have to sort of see the numbers. I saw this myself firsthand when I was doing some reporting in Chicago, and I spent some time in the courthouse, and it's just stunning to sit up there and to see the number of cases over debt collection that involve hospitals, doctors, medical providers. I just, you know, half of them, and name after name after name. It is a huge source. It's a huge source because it's something that is so common, and the money involved is so big compared to people, when you're dealing with people who don't have health insurance in particular.
Yeah. There is a chapter in the book about Chicago and a woman by the name of Mary John Binder. Tell us her story.
Yeah, that was an unusual story in some respects. She was a former nun living in Chicago. She was the living with an elderly woman who she'd come to know, and she was taking care of her. She did not make a lot of money. She had left her order, but she had maintained her vow of poverty and was still doing community service. She became faint one day and was taken to an emergency room. They thought she was having a heart attack. Turned out she was fine. She was not having a heart attack. She just had a little difficulty breathing in some air. But as you know, when you have an older woman fainting, you don't take chances. She got to the hospital and she told them, "I don't have health insurance." And she wanted to go see her own doctor. They said, "No, we want to check you out, but don't worry, it'll be fine." At least that's what she remembers somebody telling her. Well, it ends up she's fine, and she goes home, but then she finds out she owes the hospital $12,000. And again, it's very easy to run up a $12,000 bill in a day, less than a day. I mean, it's unbelievably how quick you can run up such a bill. Some confusion ensues, and the next thing she knows, she is being sued over that debt. Now, this happens all the time. Hospitals routinely outsource their collections to collection agencies. These are the same collection agencies that deal with automobile debt and such, and they are quite aggressive, and people frequently find themselves on the receiving end of a subpoena and a lawsuit. What was unusual in her case is that I think typically most people don't realize they can actually challenge these rulings. She did. She found out, and she ends up fighting it in court, and she ends up winning her case, but she ends up going through this whole ordeal, and as I sort of trace this ordeal, I explain, well, why is this happening? And the story is quite complicated. A lot of it has to do with the fact that we depend upon charity hospitals to provide for the uninsured. There's an assumption that they will take all, you know, that as in exchange for getting tax breaks, that they will take care of people. But during the 1990s in particular, there was a real push on hospitals to become more competitive, to adopt a more business-like model. And really, that's a metaphor for the way our healthcare system works. We've been in a mode for a while where now we keep looking to the market to solve the problem. We keep saying, well, just apply more market pressure. If we just get more competitive forces in healthcare, well, costs will come down. Well, what ends up happening is hospitals, they look at their bottom line, they say, we need to be more competitive, we need to compete with each other for business, or else we're going to go out of business ourselves. Well, how can we save money? Well, gee, we're taking care of all these people who don't have health insurance, we don't get any money from that. Well, let's not take care of them so much. And there's different ways this can happen. You can try to make it harder for them to see you, you can let them word go out that perhaps, well, if you come here, we're going to expect to be paid in full. Sometimes it happened totally unwittingly. You know, there were stories of hospitals that had outsourced collections because some consultant came to them and said, you can make more money if you collect your debts more aggressively. And they said, great. And then they found out, in some cases, to their dismay, that they were engaging in, their collection agencies were engaging in practices where you had very sick old people without a lot of money being literally hauled off in handcuffs. places. And there were some stories from Illinois about this, actually, mm-hmm. I recall. And but the result is, I mean, the broader message is that this is sort of the last, one of the sort of last safety net, the private charity care system. And it, frankly, is not caving. You know, we keep loading, as people lose insurance, you're going to be loading a greater and greater burden on the safety net. And yet it's already not capable of providing for all the people who need it.
Yeah. And it was interesting, in the end, she told you, Ms. Binder told you, making private hospitals go bankrupt isn't the answer either.
Yes, well, you know, I tried very hard in the book. It's very easy, I think, to look at stories like this and to say, oh, well, you know, drug companies are making a lot of money and insurers are making a lot of money. It's very easy to beat up on everybody, and you know, people can make their own judgments about that. I tried to, you know, really give a kind of more of a descriptive book in that sense. But, you know, one lesson I think does come out is that, you know, don't blame the actors for doing what they're supposed to do. You know, don't blame Walmart for cutting employee benefits when we live in a system where companies that do that will make more money. The problem is the system. You know, if we are not happy with the way that employers treat their employees, if we think they can't be relied upon to provide good insurance, well, then let's get them out of the loop. Don't ask them to provide insurance in the first place, because an employer has to make money. A business has to make money. It has stockholders to report to. That's always going to be its first priority. If that is its first priority, then providing health insurance could very well become something it decides it doesn't want to do. If we're going to ask hospitals to be more competitive, if we're going to ask hospitals, even nonprofit hospitals, we're telling, you have to be competitive, you have to make bigger margins. Well, where do you think they're going to cut? Of course they're going to cut on the uninsured. And that doesn't necessarily mean you can't pressure businesses to be more responsible, or hospitals that get tax breaks shouldn't live up to that responsibility. But I do think it should give us a realistic set of expectations and say that if we want everybody to have health insurance, if we want everybody to have access to affordable medical care, then we need to do something to give everybody health insurance and to give everybody access to affordable medical care. And all of this, you know, beating up on businesses and hospitals and pharmaceuticals, and well, that's all nice and well, but that's not going to solve the problem.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, journalist Jonathan Cohn, author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. When did health insurance become part of American life, and when and how did it become a standard benefit for workers?
Well, that history really takes us back to the early 1930s and the late 1920s. That is the period in American history when, for the first time, medicine really becomes sophisticated enough. The saying is that was around the time when going to the doctor or hospital, you actually stood better than a 50-50 chance of coming out and getting better. And that was great, obviously. It was a good thing that medicine advanced. It was a good thing that we could cure diseases rather than comfort people as they suffered from them. But, of course, that's when medicine got expensive, and suddenly you had large numbers of Americans who could not afford to pay their medical bills. And so we faced a choice. We needed to come up, everyone agreed that you needed to come up with some kind of insurance system, some way that you could spread the burden of medical bills to a lot of people so that you had a lot of healthy people, in effect, covering the cost of that one or two unhealthy people. But how do you do that? Every other developed country in the world, when it faced this decision or sometime afterwards, came to the conclusion the best, most efficient way to do this was to get everybody together into one pool and to have one giant insurance policy, to have one national health insurance program. We did not do that. We did not do that in part because Franklin Roosevelt thought about adding national health insurance to the Social Security Act, but he was afraid the political opposition would be too fierce. And so instead what happened was the private sector decided to solve the problem on its own. Hospitals, which needed to have paying customers, basically created the first modern health insurance plans. And those plans, which grew into the Blue Cross system, became the basis for how our insurance works today. And one of their characteristics was this idea that we would link insurance to a workplace, that basically if you were working age, you were expected to get coverage through your job. And, you know, that system worked okay for a while, but it's not working anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. In 1993, you point out, General Motors said health insurance for its employees added $700 to the price of a vehicle. In 2004, the company said that cost had doubled.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, you need only to look at the troubles of the auto industry today to see that they're still struggling with this. You know, one of the, you can make, I think, in the book, and I mostly rely on arguments about why, on a human level, universal health care makes sense. You know, whether you do it out of compassion or enlightened self-interest. You know, you don't want this to happen to your brother, or maybe you don't want it to happen to you. But there's a whole other set of arguments for universal health insurance about which I also talk about, which are really about the economy. It is not good for the economy as a whole to have a system like we have. One reason is that it does penalize those companies, and they tend to be old line manufacturers that are locked into paying generous benefits. So they, you know, as if they didn't have enough trouble competing against foreign competitors, they have that weight around their legs. Another reason is that, you know, we're supposed to be, this is the United States, right? We're supposed to be the country that really supports entrepreneurship, that for people who want to be self-starters and set out on their own, that we're the country of the self-made man. Well, nothing discourages entrepreneurship more than the possibility that you might not get health insurance. One of the many dysfunctions in our healthcare system is that because it is built around large workplaces, if you work in a small business or if you work for yourself, you find it very difficult to buy health insurance, particularly if you have some kind of pre-existing condition, and you probably won't be able to buy insurance at all. Well, that is an enormous disincentive for people to go strike out on their own. And if you think about it, an economy ought to encourage people to take risks, because risks end up, it's through those risks that you get innovation. It's through those risks you get economic success. But to encourage people to take those risks, you need to insulate them a little bit. You need to protect them. You need to say that if you take this risk and your business doesn't work out, or you take this risk and it does work out even, that you don't need to then worry that you're going to get sick and go bankrupt because you didn't have health insurance. Well, but that's exactly what we do right now.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's not smart economically.
What do the economists have to say about that? Do they take your point? Are there economists out there who are putting that argument forward? Are there economists who say you're all wet?
No. There's definitely an argument. I think in general, most people would say that in general, there's a growing body of economic evidence, in fact, to suggest that as a general rule, the best way to encourage a dynamic economy, and by that we mean one where people feel free to take risks, where the job force can change and the workforce can change and companies can change to accommodate changing demands, is to protect people individually, to say that we want you to take these risks, we want to expose you to these forces because they make our economy grow faster in the long run, but we understand that that may hurt you on an individual basis, and we don't want you to have to worry that, you know, you're going to completely go bankrupt or that your life will be ruined, so we protect you against these things. There is something called job lock, which is this phenomenon where people who are in good, have good benefits, are less likely to change jobs or leave their jobs and start on their own because they're afraid of losing their health insurance. I think most economists would say that it exists. How big an issue it is something they would debate. But you know, the other thing that I think economists who have really looked at this hard will tell you, I mean, you don't hear this a lot from politics, but there's not a lot of evidence that we spend all this extra money beyond what every other country in the world does. There's not a lot of evidence to suggest we actually get something for that money. We don't seem to be getting better health care. We don't seem to be getting more health care. What we have is an awful lot of waste.
Hmm. An entrepreneur that we meet in the book, that readers will meet, who has a pre-existing condition is Janice Ramsey. And her story has another twist to it as well. Tell us about her.
Well, she has she is a very successful woman in her own business. She's a self-made woman, you would say. She's run her own business. She lives in Central Florida. Her one problem is that she has diabetes. No insurer will cover her, except the ones who say that, yes, we will cover you, but we won't cover anything related to your diabetes, which, if you know anything about diabetes, is more or less like saying we won't cover you. And for a long time, she's desperate to buy insurance. She has the money to pay for, you know, any kind of reasonably priced premium. She just can't find an insurance company to offer it to her. Finally, one day she does. Along comes an insurer with an impressive-looking package. They are plugged into the best doctors and hospitals in the Orlando area. Their literature looks top-notch. And they'll cover her diabetes at a reasonable price. So she's very excited about it. It seems just about too good to be true. Well, a year and a half later, it does turn out to be too good to be true. Here she was getting medical care and running up bills, and then she starts to learn that the bills weren't getting paid. And eventually, after complaining enough times, becoming frustrated, she goes to the state of Florida and says, "Can you help me? My insurance company won't pay my bills." And they're supposed to, and the state has to break the news to her, "Well, really, you're not actually covered at all. That's a fraudulent carrier. It's not licensed to do business here in the state of Florida." And she ends up, this is very, turns out to have been very common at the time. There's a whole wave of scandals of people running these scams where they'd get people and they'd focus on people just like Janice Ramsey who couldn't buy insurance.
And I don't know what happened there, but we'll find out what the story is there, and we'll get our guest Jonathan Cohn back on the air as soon as we can. Jonathan is the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. And also we've got a listener waiting to talk with us, and if that caller will just bear with us, we hope to get you connected with our guest Jonathan Cohn in just a moment. And we're back, I think.
Back. I must have been the healthcare industry buzzing in there. I'm not sure what happened.
Yeah.
Anyway, as I was saying, so it turned out it was a fraudulent carrier, and she was left with literally a five-figure hospital debt that she had no idea she even had. And by the time she found out about it, she was already late making payments, so her once pristine credit rating was ruined. And meanwhile, she found herself, she's uninsured all over again with no health insurance coverage, right back where she started.
Let's take this call now. A listener waiting to talk with you, Jonathan, in Eureka, Illinois, on line four. Hi.
Hi. The last time I talked to a denominational insurance agency, I guess I became exceedingly cynical, and maybe I shouldn't have, but every time I keep hearing, and this was after the premiums had gone up like 24-25%, and I keep hearing about the cost and about everything else. I kept wondering, am I the only one that's cynical? Because nothing else in the general economy has gone up at the rate of 20 or 25% of the year. There are increases, and then I remember there was a doctor's wife who made some kind of, I guess to me it's an idiotic comment. It was something like this: "Well, consumers are demanding all this multi-million dollar equipment." Is he out?
I don't think so. Jonathan, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I have no idea where this is.
Maybe they're trying to zap me from my cynical attitude. I was about ready to say, you know, I know people that have insurance that are still afraid to go to the doctor. Could you comment about what to me seems to be the unconscionable rate of increases both for insurance and medical costs? It just seems so...
Sure, absolutely. There's sort of two things. Were you buying insurance on your own as an individual
It's through a group plan, but...
Through a group plan?
No, as an individual. I'm sorry, as an individual, but...
That's what I thought. There's two things going on there. First of all, in general, there's the overall, why is medicine getting so expensive overall? And there's a number of reasons why. Every country in the world is finding, obviously, as people get older and our technology gets better, there is a demand for more care. So that's the germ of truth in what that person was saying, that it is true. We are all demanding more and expensive treatments, and at some point we have to pay for them. So that will cost us more money. But our system is the worst of all the systems out there at figuring out at keeping that cost reasonable. We have no way to sort of set a global budget. We have no way to say this is how much money we want to spend. Now let's sort that out accordingly. In addition to that, we alone have a crazy system where there's all these different people paying into the system. So if you want to try to control costs on one end or another, the analogy you often hear is a balloon. So you try to control costs, and say Medicare says it wants to not pay as much. Well, then people just start charging more money to private health insurance and such. So you have that problem. When you're in the individual market, you have a second problem, which is that this happens all the time, which is large group plans tend to be reasonably steady, relatively speaking. You know, they don't go up that much year to year. I mean, they do go up a lot, and you'll hear business complain about it, but within a certain predictable range. Individual insurance policies, they will vary wildly, and they will vary wildly depending on the claims you make in an individual year. They can sometimes, and they will also vary wildly because that's a very volatile business. Companies come in, companies come out. They undercut, they underprice to get you on, and then they charge, they raise the rates to get rid of people they don't want. And so this is a classic case of how, again, in our system, it doesn't control costs overall. And then people who are individuals, who are entrepreneurs, again, in a country where we're supposed to reward that, get punished the most.
Do you know what the general rule of thumb for the last 2 or 3 years as far as at what rate general medical costs have risen?
You know, I'd have to go back and check the figures, but in general, the last couple of years, we've been between, if I recall, this is really off the top of my head, so don't quote me on this, 8 and 12%, somewhere in that range. I mean, that's usually where it's been in the sort of bad years, and in the good years, it goes up, you know, and sometimes we get it down to more like when managed care was really taking a bite out of medical costs in the mid-90s, it was down to 2 or 3%. But lately it's been, again, this is really off the top of my head, but 8 to 12%. So if your insurance premiums are going up 25%, 50%, something else was going on.
Yeah, it went down to about 6, but I just think something. I guess I just don't believe them, and I guess I tend to believe greed and just money has been the only really consequence. They can talk all they want to about, you know, their platitudes about patient care and about this. It just seems to me to be about money. And go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, and again, you know, this is also a function. You see this more in the individual market. The large insurance carriers who administer the plans for the big companies, and of course, the big companies pay their own claims. They just contract out with insurers to run the plans. It's not even the insurance company's money. They tend to be pretty stable. The small companies, the small insurance market, they stay away from because it's just so volatile. And so you get a lot of fly-by-night companies that come in, try to make a killing, and leave. I don't want to disparage every company that operates in that market. There's some perfectly good ones, but you know that's really the kind of wild west of health insurance, if you will. And it's one of the best reasons I think to have universal health care is that we tell people, you know, small business individuals, they just really struggle in this system, and there's no reason for that.
Thank you.
In terms of this wild west idea of health care, how aggressively have the states been in going after this kind of thing?
Well, they've been very aggressive. I mean, it depends. You know, obviously, it depends on what state you live in.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the states have been very aggressive. The problem is, this is a case where complexity is a problem. It's such a complex system, our health insurance system, and there's so many overlapping regulations that often state authorities themselves aren't sure what they have the power to regulate and what they don't. In fact, in those scams like we were talking about a little earlier, the one that Janice Ramsey, that woman in Florida, fell into. Well, those kinds of scams, a big reason why those scam artists were able to operate was that there is a federal law that exempts a lot of the group insurance plans from state regulation, specifically certain large companies who do what's called self-insurance, which is what I was just talking about, where
mm-hmm.
the company itself basically pays the claims, but they hire an insurance company to administer it. Well, a lot of what would happen was these scam artists would say to people, you know, if somebody asked them, well, are you licensed to sell this insurance in my state? If you're in Florida, you would say, are you licensed to sell in the state of Florida? And they would say, well, no, but we don't have to because we have an exemption from this law, which is called ERISA. You know, we have an ERISA exemption, and everyone in insurance knows what an ERISA exemption means, and so people wouldn't think twice about it. Even people who knew about health insurance, I mean, you had to be pretty sophisticated to even ask about that. Someone says ERISA exemption, you assume, oh, okay, well, sure. And it turned out, well, they didn't have an ERISA exemption, in fact, but they... You know, it was confusing enough that it took the authorities a while to catch up with these scams.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
To what extent is the problem of fear of liability, of lawsuits, adding to the cost? Do you have any kind of estimate that the idea that doctors will almost automatically do all sorts of tests because they have to cover their rear ends? I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. I will preface that with saying that I am not a fan of our malpractice system. I don't think it serves anybody well. I don't think it serves the doctors well. I think there's a cloud of suspicion that hangs over a lot of good doctors for no reason. I think it does not serve the patients well. I think there have been studies that show that most people who are victimized by medical error don't actually end up compensated. You know, it's a pretty good system for trial lawyers. So I'm all up for reforming it in an intelligent way, as long as it's something that doesn't just simply that actually protects patients. You have to do it in a way that actually, you know, improves the quality of care. With that out of the way, I will tell you that a lot of, you know, this is always what you hear from people who oppose universal health care. They say, well, that's not our problem. Our problem is that all this defensive medicine is running up really high medical costs? Well, people have studied this. People have looked at it. As far as I know, there's only been one credible study ever, original, in terms of original research. And maybe there's another, I just don't know about it. But, you know, among major researchers, there's one study that often gets cited, but just one, where they found a significant relationship between malpractice and higher healthcare costs. And it wasn't even that big, and no one else has been able to replicate that result. And so the generally accepted wisdom by most economists is that you may or may not want to change the malpractice system because you think it's a bad system. But if you're looking to malpractice as the reason why we spend so much in healthcare, well, that's you're barking up the wrong tree. That is not the problem. It is at most a tiny factor in higher healthcare costs, even when you account for things like defensive medicine.
Hmm. As I mentioned in my introduction, you mentioned in your introduction, it's time for a new political discussion, a new political debate on healthcare. And it seems to me that by and large, a lot of people are in agreement. We've got some very serious problems. The question is, you know, where do we go from here, I guess? Do we embark on the kinds of change you would like to see incrementally or more with greater gusto?
Well, I think we have an opportunity to create a universal healthcare system, by which I mean an opportunity to say, we will do what every other country does. We will give everybody health insurance. Now, there are a lot of different ways to do that. On one extreme, you have what's called a single-payer system, where the government provides everybody with insurance directly. If that sounds foreign, it shouldn't. That's what we do with the elderly. That's what Medicare is. On the other end, you have systems where really you continue to rely on private health insurance, but the government finances it and the government regulates it so that everybody can get it, everybody does get it, and it's affordable for everybody. If you remember back to the Clinton health care plan of 1993, 1994, that was what it tried to do. There are arguments to be made for all of these different approaches. I like single payer. I think at the end of the day, it's the most efficient, gets you the most bang for your buck. So if I were king for a day and I could, or particularly if I could go back in a time machine to the 1930s when this whole system got started, I would certainly create a single payer system. I'd probably look something like Medicare, where there was a basic government program and then people could buy supplemental insurance on top of it to cover what the basic insurance didn't. Since I can't go in a time machine and I'm not king for a day, I tend to have a pretty open attitude about, well, you know, if you have a different way to get to universal coverage, let's talk about it. You know, there's plans out there now that are not single-payer, but I think this shows certain promise. But I do think, at least for now, you know, we should be talking about universal coverage. There's no reason to talk about incremental expansions, by which I mean we shouldn't be saying, well, we'll just insure kids or we'll just help small business. You know, I think we're past that. We're past that because people want more. And I think, frankly, those solutions are, in the best of worlds, they are Band-Aids. In the best of worlds, they get you a little more coverage for a while. And I don't mean to disparage them. I mean, I'm thrilled that we expanded Medicaid and created the state children's health insurance program in the 90s. You know, millions of children who would otherwise not have had health care got it because of those programs. So that's a great thing. I don't in any way want to dismiss those. But at the end of the day, they don't fix the system. They plug a hole here. They plug a hole there. And more it's becoming apparent that just the system as a whole is extracting costs. I mean, forget the social compassion, forget the morality arguments, forget the even the enlightened self-interest that, you know, gee, I might be one of these people who's uninsured. You know, it's bad for business. It's bad for American competitiveness. It's just inconvenient and confusing. Anyone who's ever had to spend a lot of extra time at a pharmacy, like I did not too long ago when I was filling a prescription for my son because there was some problem with the insurance card and we took forever. Well, you know, under a well-functioning universal health care system, that doesn't happen. And it's inconvenient and it costs us money. I mean, that was lost productivity for me and for the pharmacist. And, you know, look, I'm lucky. I don't really have, you know, we didn't really have any serious health problems. But you add that on top of people who do, well, that just seems pretty absurd.
Hmm. Some states have begun to take action on their own. Massachusetts, California, Illinois, our governor would very much like to do this, but it's a big question is how in the heck are we going to pay for it? Are there some state programs out there that could be models for a U.S. approach to universal care?
Well, certainly all of us who follow health policy are watching extremely closely what is happening in Massachusetts, where Mitt Romney, before stepping down as governor, Republican governor, former governor Mitt Romney, signed into law a measure that's supposed to create universal coverage there. And we're also keeping an eye on California, where they are Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, another Republican governor has proposed universal health care. Those two states are both proposing to do variations on a particular kind of model that's getting a lot of attention. It's the same with a much different set of details around it, but the basic model is the same one that Senator John Edwards has proposed for the whole entire country. It's called an individual mandate, and the basic idea is that everybody is required to buy health insurance in exchange for requiring that. The state then says, we'll make sure health insurance is available to you. It remains to be seen whether they can make this work on a state level. It's very, very hard to fix health care on a state-by-state basis when you have all this national stuff going on. Massachusetts and California may be the two states that can get away with it. California, because it's so big and it has so much clout that it has extra bargaining leverage. You know, one problem with trying to do this by a state-by-state basis is if you're working with private insurance companies, if they don't like the deal you're offering them, they'll just walk away. Mm. And this has happened in a lot of states. Well, they're not going to walk away from California.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Has there been any discussion? Has anybody talked about states coming together in compacts?
You know, there has been some discussion. I'm trying to remember the last. I mean, there was some in New England. You know, this came up with the prescription drug benefit, uh-huh. Medicare, I seem to recall. But, you know, the second reason I was going to say is that it does require that you have to be skeptical about the states, and this feeds into what you were saying about Illinois. There's a money issue. States are in a funny position. They don't frequently have the money to do this, in part because they can't borrow money. So they have to kind of, their money goes up and down with the economy, which is exactly the opposite of what you want to do with health insurance. Because, of course, when do you need state health insurance? When the economy's down. That's when you have the least amount of money with taxes to play with. And again, it is, you know, this is solving this problem, getting the healthcare system in order, really is a national issue. It's really hard to do this by pecking at a problem here and there and there. You really kind of need to get your arms around the whole thing, and it's almost impossible to do that when you're not in Washington. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Mitt Romney and John Edwards, and they're both candidates for president. There's a very crowded field of presidential candidates in the Republican and Democratic parties. Where on the agenda is health care in this 2008 campaign?
Well, it's easy to forget, given all the coverage it's getting now, but we're still very early. So, you know, I hesitate. I'm not one for, you know, overly broad predictions, but certainly if things stay the way they are now, I would expect this to be the most important domestic policy issue of the election. Again, it affects an enormous amount of people. Business is anxious. The politicians are all talking about it. Even the ones who don't like it are talking about it. I think it is a given that whoever the Democratic presidential candidate is will be running on a pledge to create universal health care. If they don't have a detailed plan, they'll at least have some principles. It may very well be Hillary Clinton, who's done this once before and who has, as she likes to say, the scars to show for it. And, you know, I think she would argue that maybe history will look a little more kindly upon that effort, that maybe she was trying to do the right thing after all, even though it didn't work back then. So I think we'll be hearing a lot about this in the coming election, and I think that's a good thing. I think if we're going to get universal health care, it will be because we start talking about it now and we build political momentum for it now. I think waiting until January 2009 when the new president takes office, I think, is a mistake.
Mm. Jonathan, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Sorry about the technical problems there.
Yeah, it's okay. Jonathan Cohn has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. The publisher is HarperCollins.